on air, online, on digital, and the ABC Listen app. The Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Coming up today, the Tasmanian company trying to keep it local with their product.
Everyone else wanted to sell me Chinese dried apple when I was looking for dried apple, which I found incredibly frustrating. Particularly at the time we were living in a place where literally at the end of our street was an old apple drying factory.
But the fish and chip retailer getting his chips from Germany.
We've got to be concerned about this because what happens, you've got you take your chips out, you've got them in the tray ready to go, and there was quite a lot of green chips. They've got green ends on, and of course you can't serve a green potato.
Yes, the story of the fish and chip man who says the Australian chips were too green and is now sourcing the frozen chips from Germany. That story coming up on this Tuesday. G'day, Tony Briscoe with you. Another windy day. Trust you're coping well. Also coming up today, a story of a niche Tasmanian business in the Huon Valley going out of their way to source Tasmanian ingredients, including rejecting dried Chinese apple. That story a little bit later in the program. And more on the Northwest Transmission development in the state. We'll hear from Tas Farmers CEO Nathan Kalman, who says landholders in the Northwest whose property is close to the proposed transmission lines should be given proximity compensation. But we also hear from the Energy Minister, who says that is not being considered at the moment by Tas Networks. Even for a section of the project that does not have transmission lines at the moment, but will when the project goes ahead. You might have some thoughts on that. 0438 922 936. We will check the latest on the weather with a detailed look at conditions at the halfway stage. And also coming up today, the company behind Roundup says it's getting ready to launch a brand new herbicide in Australia. First up, though, Northwest Tasmanian landholders whose properties are near the planned Northwest Transmission development will not be compensated for any loss of value for their land. Tasmanian Energy Minister Nick Dygan confirmed there'll be no proximity compensation payments when answering a question in State Parliament from the Independent Member for Braddon, Craig Garland.
While I understand most of the towers will be next to existing transmission lines, the 17-kilometre section from East Camp to Highclere, and if stage two of the project goes ahead, the 60-kilometre section from Hampshire Hills to Staverton will be a new route. Owing to the growing public opposition to these sorts of developments, Victoria and New South Wales are offering significant compensation payments to neighbouring landowners whose visual amenity is impacted by transmission lines. Minister, what compensation will Tas Networks be offering those landowners whose land is not directly traversed by the new towers, but will nevertheless depreciate in value because they are in the line of sight or close proximity to those towers?
As I articulated yesterday, there are substantial areas of compensation payments available to people hosting transmission. There are strategic benefits payments, likewise, that are being rolled out through other jurisdictions that we're offering. It's a really delicate balance because the numbers are substantial in quantity. As I was alluding to yesterday, for example, the strategic benefits payments by itself, which is not the largest part of the compensation, is $200,000 indexed per kilometre. Now, if you look at the stage one of Northwest Transmission, that's 130 kilometres, so it's substantial, just the strategic benefits payment. The LAA compensation is a quantum higher again. So it's, you know, it is, I think the last number I saw for that, which was some time ago, I must admit, $461,000 per kilometre as an average. It will be higher and lower in some circumstances. So we're talking about substantial quantums of money. That money needs to be recovered from customers. So we have a delicate balance here about building the infrastructure we need without unduly burdening our customer base, and you know, I'm committed to finding a fair and reasonable pathway for affected landholders. I think what you're talking about is an issue that is emerging potentially in some other jurisdictions. I would I would urge caution to us as we consider those things that add substantial cost to Tasmania, because in the Tasmanian context, it's important to recognise that we have a small customer base.
Question was, will there be compensation for neighbouring land holders next to the transmission lines?
At the time, we're contemplating that is not being considered at this time.
The Energy Minister, Nick Dargan, confirming there is no proximity payments to landholders whose properties are near the planned Northwest transmission development. He was answering a question in State Parliament from Braddon MP Craig Garland. Well, TAS Farmers CEO Nathan Kalman believes the compensation issue should be on the table, especially with the new sections of the project like East Cam to Highclere, where there are currently no transmission lines on properties.
I guess it's disappointing on behalf of those landholders that are in neighbouring parcels of land. You only have to look at what's happening across the east coast of Australia, particularly New South Wales and Victoria at the moment, to understand that, you know, some of the challenges associated with building renewables and transmission lines across privately owned land is a really hot topic. You know, it really needs broader recognition, I think, from government around some of the challenges associated with making these projects have social licence.
Should there be proximity payments?
I think there should be. TasFarmers has been working with landholders through the Northwest now for over 2 years. If you're hosting transmission lines on your land, you'll be eligible for Land Acquisition Act compensation payments, and you know, we're in the final stages of negotiating strategic benefit payments for those landholders as well. However, neither of those two mechanisms apply to neighbouring landholders. And in a state like Tasmania, where parcels of land are somewhat smaller than Victoria and New South Wales, we time and time again hear that there are landholders who may have their property that they live in directly adjacent to a power line within 50 metres or 100 metres, but the power line actually sits on a neighbour's land, and they'd essentially be eligible for no compensation under the current arrangements.
What happens with wind farms at the moment?
So wind farms, I guess, as private developments versus public developments, have a very different process. So traditionally, the host of the wind farm would receive a rent payment for the life of the turbines being on that land. So that would probably be 30 to 40 years at the moment, and they'd receive that payment for the life of the project, and then at the end of the project, the infrastructure would be removed. As part of that process, renewable proponents will work with neighbouring landholders to come up with compensation arrangements that make them feel like they're duly considered. And I guess when the state government consulted around the Northwest Renewable Energy Zone last year, they actually spoke a lot about the importance of considering neighbours and having meaningful proximity payments for landholders on neighbouring properties whose amenity or property value may diminish through these projects. So I guess what we've heard loud and clear is that landholders think it's quite unfair that where a transmission line is publicly owned through TAS Networks or the state government, that it doesn't seem fair that those neighbouring landholders won't be eligible for any sort of compensation, despite the fact that their property value or ability to use it will be reduced.
The minister makes the point that the cost of doing that has to be taken back from the public, which means higher prices, I'm assuming.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, that is true. There's no getting around that. Somebody has to pay. I think the unique thing with the Northwest Transmission Development, though, which often isn't discussed, is that the full cost of that project will be borne by Tasmanian electricity consumers or major industrials or small business, large business. However, the majority of the benefit of that line will flow to consumers on the mainland. And I think it's a timely reminder that with projects like this developing everywhere, I think as a country we need to have a conversation about the fact that the true users should pay. So much like Project Marinus, where 80% of the cost will probably be borne by mainland consumers. The same should be true for the Northwest Transmission Development. And I think it's probably unfair that just because we're a small state and having to bear the cost of this project, that, you know, landholders should be the ones that miss out on compensation arrangements.
Are there still a few landholders to come to terms with the offer from TasNetworks?
So the hosting landholders on the large have now, you know, started having conversations with TasNetworks about the Land Acquisition Act payments. And most of them that we have been talking to have been reasonably positive about TasNetworks' current approach in how they're dealing with them, their ability to, you know, adjust the placement of towers to reduce impact on farming operations, and I guess the compensation offers that have been put to them. That definitely helps them come to terms with the project and what it will mean for their farming operations. However, the strategic benefit payment element, you know, is still ongoing, but we're hoping to be able to wrap that up over the next month or so.
Now, the whole project is on public display at the moment. Public submissions are being taken, I think, up until the 18th of this month. Will that change anything?
I think it should. And I mean, in my mind, you know, the negotiation process and the knowledge for landholders of what they will receive probably should be settled first. This matter's sort of been going on for a long time now, and the issue of proximity payments has been probably raised for over 3 years with government. I think for any project, whether it's public or private, having all of those details settled before the design, you know, goes to public consultation is important, because getting those things right creates public acceptance and allows these sorts of projects that, you know, most people will acknowledge are important, can actually move forward in a timely way without, you know, being tied up in undue process and extended community consultation because broad agreement can't be reached.
Are you happy with the way this project is moving?
Look, I think it's had a sluggish start, but more recently I think, you know, TasNetworks in particular have been very accommodating with landholders and have changed their approach, which, you know, is quite pleasing. But I think we really would have liked to have seen all of these matters wrapped up some months ago.
The CEO of TasFarmers, Nathan Kalman, on the Northwest Transmission Development, where he says proximity compensation payments should be made to landholders whose properties are near the transmission corridor. Well, the Albanese Labor government has announced a review into the Tasmanian Freight Equalisation Scheme is now underway, delivering on its election commitment. The scheme financially supports Tasmanian Freight, including the state's world-class produce and passengers across Bass Strait. The review will consider if the equalisation scheme could better support local businesses, including farmers and producers, to compete in domestic and other markets. And it will also consider how the Bass Strait passenger vehicle equalisation scheme is reducing the cost of moving passenger vehicles across Bass Strait. The review will be carried out by newly appointed independent reviewers, Dr. David Parmeter and Dr. Jenny Gordon. Coming up, we'll talk about chemicals.
The social media ban for children under 16 is coming, and we will explain everything you need to know. What's your view? Will it work? How will it affect you? Let us know what's on your mind. Go to abc.net.au/yoursay.
Coast to coast, this is the Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
The company behind Roundup says it's getting ready to launch a brand new herbicide in Australia. Bayer says its first new chemical of its kind to hit the market in more than 3 decades, but not everyone is convinced it's the answer to glyphosate resistance, as Brandon Long reports.
It's called icofolin methyl, and global agribusiness giant Bayer says it's the first new chemical specifically designed to kill sprouted weeds by attacking their leaves in 3 decades. It's already going through the approval process in Europe, the US, Canada and Brazil, with an application in Australia on the cards next year. If approved, it could be in use on local farms by 2028. Warren Inwood from Bayer Crop Science Australia and New Zealand says icofolin isn't replacing glyphosate, it's meant to work alongside it.
I don't see icofolin as a direct replacement. I see it probably more as an alternative for growers to access a new product to control Roundup-resistant weeds, more difficult to control weeds. It has been a great challenge. I think that is the holy grail in R&D herbicide activity, is trying to find something to replace Roundup or glyphosate, which is as safe as glyphosate.
Like Roundup, Icafolin's what's called a non-selective herbicide, meaning it'll kill all plants it touches. And there is a big need for new chemistry, with some weeds becoming practically immune to glyphosate. The Grains Research and Development Corporation says herbicide resistance is costing Australian growers about $3.3 billion every year. Warren Inwood says it's performed well in local trials, especially against one of farmers' biggest headaches, glyphosate-resistant ryegrass.
So far, the trial results look very exciting. So, trial data to date does demonstrate that it will be a novel solution and it will combat a significant number of resistant weeds, including ryegrass, actually, and other hard-to-control weeds.
On the ground, farmers like Stuart McIntyre on Queensland's Darling Downs are hopeful.
I think it's always pretty exciting as a grain grower or grain producer that we've got extra arsenal in our weaponry against the constant battle of weeds.
He's noticed that even common thistles are tougher to kill these days. What used to take a light dose of glyphosate now needs a mix of different products. He says a new option is especially needed in areas riddled with ryegrass. But like most farmers, he's watching the price tag.
I've been only farming 13, 14 years now, and in that short amount of time, I've noticed thistles going from a fairly low dose of Roundup killing them to now having to use those complementary other herbicides along with glyphosate to knock down that thistle. So to be able to use something else again would be of great benefit. We hope that this new product won't see a big costing so that it can be useful to growers without a high price tag with it.
But not everyone's convinced. Environmental group Friends of the Earth Australia says there's still a lot we don't know, especially about long-term effects. In a statement, land use researcher Anthony Amos says there are currently no details about the potential impacts on birds, bees and aquatic life, or spray drift and water contamination. Before it can be sold or used, the new weed killer will need approval from the Australian Pesticides and Veterinary Medicines Authority, the APVMA, which says it draws from a wide range of data during the approval process.
Brendan Long reporting there on the company behind Roundup. Bayer says it's getting ready to launch a brand new herbicide in the country. Well, a judgment against an aerial crop spraying company in New South Wales could have implications for all crop spraying businesses, according to the Aerial Application Association of Australia. The crop dusting company is facing a damages bill for $670,000 after a judge found the company had poisoned a cotton crop with a toxic herbicide 2,4-D. David Claughton has the story.
The New South Wales District Court heard that in November 2022, Hardy Irrigation in Collyamberley in the Riverina hired the crop dusting company, which trades as Mass Ag, to spray several cotton fields with the herbicide Weedmaster. 19 days after the spraying, the young cotton plants began showing severe and distinctive signs of poisoning. Judge Robert Newlands, SC, concluded that the crop was affected by the herbicide 2,4-D, which probably came out of the defendant's plane and was not caused by spray drift from neighbouring properties or by hardy irrigation themselves. Barrister James Catlin, representing the crop dusting firm, says they are considering an appeal against the judgment.
So the farmers in this case, who mostly did their own spraying, had shocking records as to their own chemical storage possession and use in circumstances where the very poison successfully alleged to have damaged their crops was in their possession and its use was unexplained. Whereas the crop dusters had no 2,4-D, that was the poison, in their possession, and not only kept near perfect records of their possession and use of chemicals, their loading of the herbicide onto the plane, and the herbicide, the purity of it, you could see from its dark blue colour, their loading of it onto the plane was actually videoed.
Judge Robert Newlands was saying that it's the damage was inconsistent with spray drift. It was highly unlikely the farmer had accidentally poisoned the exact same area themselves. And if it's not from the plane, where's it from?
Well, the farmers did 31 chemical applications of their own. Actually, I think it was 33. The only chemical applications by the crop dusters, they did two. So that's why records are so important. If you're going to assume that it's the crop dusters, you need to lock out the possibility that the farmers have damaged their own crop.
The association representing crop sprayers has warned the decision has broad implications for the sector. Matthew Harper, CEO of the Aerial Application Association of Australia, says he's concerned about a number of issues raised by the decision and it will undermine confidence in the system.
The claim is that 2,4-D was in a chemical batch, or that the aircraft was contaminated, or that it was deliberately added and it was applied across a field, but it didn't show up until 19 days later. If 2,4-D had have been sprayed by that aircraft, you would have expected to see that a day, 2 days later of starting to yellow off. So
you think it would have showed up quicker than the 19 days that I think that the evidence suggests?
If the chemical in question was used, it should have shown up within 48 hours. They should have seen an effect. It does everywhere else in the country, so I don't know why this particular field should be different.
Does the decision have any implications for your sector, for other crop sprayers then, do you think?
This has an implication to every form of spraying or every form of application, be it from the air or be it from ground rigs or be it from farmers applying their own chemicals. If you do not have to use the science to say somebody else has caused a problem, and you can, I guess, cherry pick your science, then there's nothing to stop anyone sort of running into issues that somebody says, hey, you sprayed my crop, you sprayed it 3 weeks ago with an agent that should have killed everything within a day, and now 3 weeks later it's starting to yellow off. And we've also got a really strange application of the Damage from Aircraft Act, which is an act that was designed for when items, you know, legitimately fall off aircraft and cause damage. It wasn't ever intended to be used in a deliberate application case, and losses from deliberate application are much higher on the proof of evidence, which is what we've previously seen other court cases refer to.
Matthew Harper, CEO of the Aerial Application Association of Australia. The growers, Hardy Irrigation, issued a statement through their legal firm saying the relationship between crop dusters and farmer is a very important one in country Australia, especially in times when there is an inability to use ground rigs due to soil and weather conditions. An important aspect of that relationship, they say, is ensuring that the work crop dusters do is done in a careful and safe manner. The decision, the legal company says, has ensured that our client will be compensated for their loss, which was caused by their crops being aerially sprayed by the defendants.
That's David Claughton with that report. Let's head now off the coast of Tasmania to Truwana, Cape Barron Island. Indigenous rangers on the island are on the front line in a fight against a weed which is threatening coastal ecosystems. To battle this weed, they're using a fungus, and it's proving so successful, the method is now being rolled out across the rest of the country. Louise Myerlin has the story.
The beaches of Truwana, Cape Barron Island, off the coast of Tasmania, are pristine. But there's something in the sand that shouldn't be here.
Smothering it, burning it, trying to pull it out manually, everything possible, and it's just no matter what you do, it always comes back.
Indigenous ranger Shane Hughes is talking about sea spurge. It's a stubborn weed that grows on this island and right across the southern parts of Australia.
It grows about half a metre high and just light green, goes, covers ground everywhere, sort of milky sap inside. If you break it in half, if you get it in your eyes, it can make you go blind. I don't know how much need of it in there, but it's no good for you.
You may well have seen sea spurge's green squishy tendrils on your local beach in WA, South Australia, Victoria, New South Wales or Tassie, growing from the high water mark into the sand dunes. It looks harmless, but its poisonous toxins can cause temporary blindness. And as CSIRO's Ben Gooden explains, this weed can devastate a coastal ecosystem.
It is one of the most problematic species that occurs along the beaches and coastlines across southern Australia, particularly through the impacts that it has on native vegetation, but also how those beaches are utilised by many different shorebird species, particularly some of our threatened shorebird species like the hooded plover. Many of these nesting shorebirds require particular types of sandy habitats to set up their nesting sites, and when those areas get smothered by sea spurge, hundreds of thousands of plants of sea spurge, it just creates this carpet of vegetation that those birds no longer can nest in safely.
Sea spurge is native to southern Europe, North Africa and Western Asia, but not Australia. Its seeds are easily dispersed on land and in the ocean, and it's thought to have arrived to Australia in water carried on ships about 70 years ago. Here on Truwana, Cape Barron Island, the Truwana Rangers have been working with CSIRO to innovate the battle against sea spurge. Their weapon of choice? A spray bottle full of fungus.
Classical biological control, we go to where the weed is native in Europe and we look at all of the different insects and fungi that are natural enemies of sea spurge, and we identify which one has the biggest impact on the plant and keeps the plant's populations in check. Then we do what's termed host specificity testing, where we bring, in this case, a fungus into Australia in quarantine, and we test to make sure that that fungus is absolutely safe and cannot infect or reproduce on any native plant species in Australia. And on that basis, it is safe and is given approval for release. And the project was to release the fungus into the Australian environment to reconnect with the weed. And when the fungus establishes and it grows on the plant, it reduces how well the plant can grow.
Before we tried it, was all sceptical and didn't really want to release it because we didn't know what it was going to do, but we're glad we did because it's done well so far.
The fungus is reducing sea spurge on the island. You can see the weeds turning brown, which is a good sign. Now, CSIRO is rolling out the sprayable fungicide across mainland Australia. It's already been used on the main island of Tasmania and in Victoria, and WA and South Australia are next on the list. For Ben, the project is about much more than weeds.
Weeds are a people problem, and it's through working with people as partnership that we can start tackling these weed threats. It's such a big problem, and that can feel insurmountable and it can feel demoralising, but we have to keep remembering, and it is on a personal level, but also a professional level, we achieve really good outcomes for country only through partnership.
And for Shane, keeping sea spurge at bay helps protect the land he loves.
Makes you feel good in yourself and in what you're doing in your job, and it's going to be better for the future generations as well. So, yeah, makes you feel very good in yourself.
It's Shane Hughes from the Truwana Rangers, ending that story from Louise Myelin on the efforts to combat sea spurge on Cape Barron Island. Still to come, the fish and chip supplier who's now using chips from Europe, and the Tasmanian producer determined to only use local product, and we'll check the weather as well. First up, the news headlines with Ellie Ward.
Thanks, Tony. Search teams on foot, horseback and ATVs, as well as the rescue chopper and drones, are continuing to search dense bushland in the state's northeast for 76-year-old Peter Willoughby, who's been missing since Sunday afternoon. US President Donald Trump says he's received a strong signal from Iran for his Gaza peace plan to go ahead. Meanwhile, there's been condemnation from all sides of politics after pro-Hamas graffiti appeared in Melbourne on the second anniversary of the October 7 attack in Israel. Tasmania's energy minister is urging energy retailer Aurora and the owner of the Boyer paper mill at New Norfolk to negotiate in good faith as they attempt to break an impasse over the mill's energy security. Tasmania's local government minister says poor councillor behaviour is behind a government proposal to make it easier to sack councillors. Kerry Vincent says the proposed changes to the Local Government Act came from consultation with councillors who were concerned about a lack of penalties for bad behaviour. And Queen Camilla and former British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak are among the many fans paying tribute to English author Dame Jilly Cooper, who's died at the age of 88. More news at 1.
Time now to check the latest on the weather. Michael Conway joins us from the Bureau. Hello, Michael.
G'day, Tony.
Rainfall figures, have we got any of note?
Yeah, in the 24 hours at the west mainly, in the south, Mount Bob's in the south had 21 millimetres, also 21 at Mount Reid. Pine Forest Moor had 15 millimetres, was the next in line. Since 9 a.m. there's been a few light falls, mainly in the west. Mount Reid had 4, Burberry had 3, and Kanyani, Mount Wellington 2 millimetres.
Okay, so the wind's still hanging around. What's the weather doing over the next few days?
Yeah, look, I'd love to be able to tell you the wind's easing off, but not likely till into the weekend now. And the strongest winds will be coming through Friday. There's a big, broad, low-pressure system well to our south, but it's massive. It's, you know, the width of Australia sort of thing, just to the north of Antarctica, and it's slow-moving. But we're on the very edge of it, and it's bringing these west to northwesterly winds continuously into the end of the week. There's little cold fronts and troughs moving around it that enhance winds now and again, but that'll continue into the weekend. Looks like now about Monday, Tuesday, possibly be a high-pressure system coming to the state, give us a bit of relief from the winds.
What sort of temperatures are we looking at?
For the rest of the week, tomorrow is looking a little warmer, so we're looking at 17 for Hobart, 15 for Launceston today. Tomorrow, 19 for Hobart, 16 for Launceston, just using those two as a indication. It's going to cool off a little towards the end of the week, and Saturday is looking at 13. In fact, there's some cool air coming over after the front on Friday, and it could be some low snow on the weekend.
Yes, so getting back down to those lower temperatures, winter sort of temperatures at the weekend.
Yeah, a bit of a flashback. Yeah.
Yeah. Warnings, what have we got?
There's a few wind warnings, as you'd expect, Tony. We've got a gale warning out for southern and western waters from Tasman Island to Sandy Cape for west and northwesterly winds today, and then a strong wind warning for all other remaining waters, all the southeast inshore waters and both inland lakes today. Tomorrow, the gale warnings are for southern waters, Tasman Island to Low Rocky Point, strong wind warning for all other waters around the state and also both the inland lakes. We've got a severe weather warning out for parts of the western Upper Derwent Valley and southeast forecast districts, and that's mainly about the far south and into the far southwest as well of the state. That's for currently and overnight tonight. Wind gusts could be around 100 kilometres an hour, up to 120 on elevated locations.
What sort of areas will be affected there, Michael?
Sort of inland from some Dover Southport that way, just to the very far south of the Upper Derwent, and Melaleuca that kind of way into the around the southwest. So really mostly uninhabited national parks and things like that. But
yep.
So not a lot of people there.
Okay, now the coastal waters and swell. And Andrew says, don't forget the maximum wave height with the wave rider.
Oh, sure. Yeah, so I'll do that now. We've got Cape Sorrells at 4.5 metres and Maria Island is at 1.3. The winds are fairly easy to describe. So we've got today northwesterly 30 to 40 knots about the south and the southwest and 20 to 30 knots northwesterly elsewhere. Tomorrow, north to northwesterly is 25 to 35 knots about the west until mid-afternoon, and then 20 to 30 knots in other areas and otherwise, so later than mid-afternoon in the west. The swell's about in the west and south is west to southwest at 4 to 5 metres. That'll be building to 5 to 6 later in the afternoon, and then easing tomorrow during the day to westerly at 4 to 5 metres. In the north, there's a westerly of 1 to 2 metres for today and tomorrow. And in the east, a southerly 1 to 2 metres. The offshore in the south, southwesterly 4 to 5. Tomorrow, southerly's easing a little to around 1 metre, and then 3 to 4 metres offshore in the south.
Okay, Michael, thank you for that.
Thanks, Tony.
Michael Conway from the Bureau with all the information for you. Coming up in just a moment, a food truck owner who says he's not using Australian chips now. He's using chips from Europe.
Drive with Lucy Braden.
How did a fish fin evolve into human fingers? The answer might be found in fish bums.
Drive with Lucy.
Now we're talking.
Back today on 936 ABC Radio Hobart.
Keeping you updated every day. The Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
A Victorian food truck owner says he started sourcing chips from Germany because the local product was of poor quality. David Yeardley owns the Mr. Squidgy food truck, serving seafood and chips at events throughout Western Victoria, which is close to the potato-growing region of Ballarat and Deen. He says he'd like to buy a local product, but the quality doesn't stack up.
One of our core concepts for the business was to provide high-quality food, and our core products are seafood and chips. So obviously the quality of the chips are paramount to the business going forward. And we primarily bought our supplies from two wholesalers. The Simplot chips were terrific. We were very, very, very happy with them. And everything was hunky-dory, really. And then down the track, it would have been this time last year or maybe, say, 14 months ago, the quality of the Edgil chips began to fall away. And we got a bit concerned about this, because what happens, you've got you take your chips out, you've got them in the tray ready to go, and there was quite a lot of green, the green chips. They've got green ends on, and of course you can't serve up green potatoes. So you have to pick these out. Anyway, I let it be known that the quality was dropping away and that we were going to start to look elsewhere. We had to make a decision and do something to try and improve our situation. And one of the wholesalers came up with supplies that they came from Germany. And in all honesty, after that, we've had no issues. I mean, and we've been with these now for, about a year now. And the customers are happy. That's the most important thing.
So now, instead of sourcing chips made from potatoes that are grown literally next door to you, you're sourcing chips from the other side of the world.
Yes. And it's not a decision we make lightly. I must confess, my wife and I are very, very conscious of sourcing locally. And we do it whenever we can. Obviously, we support local businesses and everything else. But when it comes to this, the quality, literally, the quality trumps all. Our aim is quality. We want a great product for our customers. That's what it's all about.
So, David, what do you think the problem has been? Do you think it's been at the farm gate, or do you think it's been in the factory, in the processing, the sorting, the pre-cooking of them?
Well, that's an interesting point, because I'm not sure about the farm gate business, because I don't know how well a farmer can pick it. But the propensity to get green chips when it comes through the system, when they've been processed, I would think is relatively easy to spot.
So, David, what are you going to do now? Will you stick with the German potatoes, or will you have another crack at the locally grown ones?
Well, that's a very, very interesting question, because at the moment I've got no reason to want to change, because my price is good, my quality is good. I've been thinking about it, and interestingly enough, we do a takeaway on a Friday night, and one of our customers, he actually works for Simplot, and he buys our fish and chips. And I mean, I've told him, I've said, you like the chips. And I was having a joke with him. I said, but I'm sorry, they're not yours. And I said to him, pass it up the line. Please, can you pass it up the line to let your people know that I'm doing this because I can't get good, I have not been able to get the good quality chips that I used to get. And I said, once they if somebody can come back and say to me, right, okay, come on, give it a crack, let's have a go, I'll be happy to do that. I really would.
Yeah, food truck owner David Yeardley speaking with Angus Verley, and Simplot was contacted for comment. Well, when COVID hit at the beginning of the decade, many took solace in new hobbies and comfort foods. That includes Cam and Ali Skeels, who had just moved to the Huon Valley from New South Wales. Faced with a tricky job market, they decided to bring together local Tasmanian ingredients into the perfect crumpet recipe. Reporter Lachlan Ford visited the Huon Me kitchen as they pumped out a batch of their buckwheat sourdough crumpets.
We were to the point in our life where kids had left home, and we had that freedom to decide where we want to go, and decided to give it a go and move down.
And you saw a gap in the crumpet market.
Yeah.
What did that look like?
It wasn't particularly clear. I mean, it was a gut feeling, really. We suspected that we could come up with a really good product. We looked to see who else was doing them. No one was doing them in Tassie. Didn't have to chuck a lot of money at it to get it started. And it was just the two of us initially in a shared kitchen in Geeston. And so it was, there was a relatively low risk, and we thought, well, we'll give it a go. And they just took off. We've gone back to essentially revived what crumpets would have been before mass production and before the introduction of baker's yeast. So we've gone back to proper old-fashioned sourdough methods. And so that one is, it's essentially a bread dough. We put milk in it to, so it's what's technically known as an enriched dough, and you have a much higher hydration or moisture content to make it a batter rather than a dough.
For crumpets, how important are fresh quality ingredients?
Yeah, it's really important. And any baker will tell you that the fresher your flour, the better. When we're doing things like the spice ones, the dried apple is a key ingredient. We personally know the people that grow the apples and dry them for us, and their quality control is amazing. So they take great pride in what they do. So it makes it really easy to use their product. You know, we sort of feel that you get what you give in many ways. And if we make a point of trying to support local producers, then that comes back in spades, really. And, I mean, it also makes sense. You're getting stuff when it's fresh. You're reducing the travel times, and you'll build a relationship with your suppliers that is better than just being someone who emails in a purchase order once a fortnight, you know. We try to keep it as local as possible. Our biggest single inputs are our flour and our milk. So flour's, the bulk of our flour is milled in Lonnie. Our milk comes from Bream Creek, so that's as local as sort of we can get these days. In these whole grain ones, all our rye flour and our whole grains all come from the grain family up near Deloraine. The buckwheat comes from Kindred. When we do our seasonal spiced fruit ones, the dried apple comes from Surges Bay, from our friends down at Surges Bay. And the apple juice that we use comes from Lucaston Park Orchards, who are almost over our back fence. So as fresh as fresh can be, and you know, we're supporting local people, and in turn we get supported.
Right. More science to it.
Certain things that obviously we're not getting locally. There's not a great coconut industry in Tasmania just yet, so we're not using local coconut milk.
Yeah, totally.
Give it a little time. With the spiced fruit ones, we put Tasmanian whiskey in them too. So we soak the dried apples and currants with apple juice and a bit of Tasmanian whiskey.
Just where's that whiskey from?
We get a lot of it from Taylor and Smith. So what we're actually able to do is use a waste product from the whiskey industry. It's the stuff in the bottom of the barrels when they pour it off. It's called flock. It's the solids and the sediments and the oils that go to the bottom and can't be bottled, so it's cloudy and yuck. But it's absolutely packed full of flavour. And we get it and it looks like dirty, muddy water with lumps of charcoal in it and stuff. And we run it through coffee filters and clean it up. And we use that because it's got so much flavour. It just adds a richness to the soaked fruit. Ironically, given that we're in the Huon, we initially had all sorts of trouble finding Tasmanian dried apple. I did find a supplier in Victoria on the Mornington Peninsula, but everyone else wanted to sell me Chinese dried apple when I was looking for dried apple, which I found incredibly frustrating. Particularly at the time we were living in a place where literally at the end of our street was an old apple drying factory that had closed down, you know, in the 70s. But I just thought, this is ridiculous. I'm in the Huon Valley. I cannot in all good conscience use Chinese dried apple. And lucky we were able to find someone who was prepared to make it for us in the Huon. So
no one else is buying Tasmanian dried apple?
or other people are now buying it from Sturgis Bay, from bobbing for apples.
I'll have a listen back to that, see if we get a...
Katie Johnston, how long have you been at bobbing for apples?
We moved from Melbourne, so two and a half years ago. So we're we're very new still.
to apple farming in general? Like, do you have a farming background?
Yeah. No, nothing at all. We thought we'd give it a go and we absolutely love it. We're a little slice of heaven down here. When we first got down here, I couldn't believe how many apples just drop on the ground and how many apples, how much fruit is just wasted. So straight away, my brain was just, what can I do with all the apples that are not good enough to sell wholesale? Started coming up with the ideas of what I can do. And dried apples were the first ones that were very easy to do. So then I met Cam and Ali. So I was able to specifically what, you know, a sweet apple, a more sour apple, and what size do you want the chunks? Do you want slices? So I was able to tailor it to them.
And what goes into dried apples as someone who's a complete novice to this?
Yeah. It's pretty simple. I used to slice them with a mandolin, you know, the slicing gadget things in the kitchen. And because it got so popular, I've upgraded to an electric slicer. So I just load the apple in that, literally just load the apple in that, and it slices it into rings. I keep the skin on and the core in because that's all your nutritional goodness is in there. I do take the pips out because once they become very firm and don't want to crack down on a pip once it's dried. So, and then I've got two commercial dehydrators that I just load those up on trays. A softer dried apple, that probably takes about 14 hours in the dehydrator. If I'm doing chips, they take 24 hours to get that really nice crunch.
What are the specific varieties of apple that you're drying?
Like, I've practiced with lots of them. We've got about 20 varieties here on the property. So Jonagold seem to work really well. It's easy to get the pips out. And then I do Granny Smith's as well because they almost taste a bit like lemonade when they've been dehydrated, dried.
Really?
Yeah, the sourness goes and the sweetness comes out a bit more. But you've still got that bit of sourness there.
And how does it feel to have, I guess, resurrected this dried apple production in the Huon Valley that's, you know, quite historical there?
Yeah, I didn't grow up here. So I'm just recently starting to learn about the history. And I think in Franklin there was a large drying plant. So, yeah, I hadn't considered that I'm resurrecting. So it's interesting that people are finding it interesting. So, yeah, but no, definitely feel very proud of our product, of our apples, and love the job that we're doing as well.
Katie Johnston from Bobbing for Apples, following on from Cam Skeels at Hugh and Me Crumpets, talking there to Lachlan Ford.
You're with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
And the Tuesday edition of the Country Hour. Well, a deadly mudslide at a major Indonesian copper mine has pushed up the value of Australian mines. The mudslide at the Garsberg mine in West Papua has forced the second largest copper mine on the planet to shut down and exacerbated a shortage of copper globally. Copper is critical for the computers that drive huge new data centres that are powering AI technology. And that's led BHP and Rio to scramble for new suppliers. There's been a flurry of mergers and acquisitions around the world, and some Australian mines are reopening for the first time in half a decade. Hayden Bairstow, head of research at finance company Argonaut, has told Clint Jasper that mining stocks are rising.
The demand story has been really bullish, and I think as we talk more about data centres and, you know, things like Oracle upgrading their cloud outlook, I mean, that's just more sort of demand for copper and for power to sort of underpin what they want to do. You know, we've seen obviously a lot of the bigger stocks in the US really rise on AI and data centres in the last couple of years. So that part of the demand story has been quite robust for a while. Whereas I think, you know, supply had been okay, and there were some big projects coming online, which had really, despite all of that positive demand signals, had pushed the market still into a surplus, where these supply issues that we've now seen have swung that pretty quickly the other way. Then the other driver of volatility in copper has been the US tariffs, and that, yeah, for a period this year, we had a very wide price gap between the US copper price and the LME price in London. That has now since narrowed a fair bit, but, you know, that created even more volatility in the copper market over the course of this year.
What's been the Australian response to that market picture? Strong demand, tight supplies. Have we seen new mines coming on? Is there money chasing, you know, previously undeveloped copper reserves?
It's actually been M&A. So we've actually lost a couple of listed companies. Matt Copper is in the throes of being taken over now by Harmony, New World Corporation, which has an asset in the US, but it was Australian listed, has also gone as well. So we've seen a bit of M&A activity on that front. We haven't had too many copper projects get advanced quickly. Probably the only thing that's been brought online is Woodlawn in New South Wales, ACT with Develop. You know, there's some other projects like Nifty in WA that are moving towards a production pathway in the next two years or so. So there is some new supply coming. Better pricing outlook will make funding some of these Australian development plays a much easier pathway. So they're pretty well positioned for some of these assets to get going and get funded. Developer also starting an underground mine at Sulphur Springs in the Pilbara. So there's another smaller copper mine coming online in the next couple of years as well. So it is quite encouraging, I think, for some assets in Australia that have been on the shelf for a long period of time to actually start being brought into production over the next sort of 3 to 5 years, particularly if the copper price is $5 a pound or higher, which it's now approaching in the spot market.
And amongst that M&A picture, are we seeing Australian companies looking overseas to either form joint ventures or take over reserves that are known in some of those copper hotspots?
It's been the other way, really, that offshore companies have been buying Australian companies. I mean, the biggest copper player in Australia, Sandfire, has their two assets, but they haven't been buying anything else. They've got a development play in the US as well, so they haven't been active on the M&A front. But yeah, it's been more the bigger offshore players and private money buying some of these smaller copper development companies on the ASX.
Against the backdrop of all of that, what's your take on why a major global company like Glencore is asking the government for money to keep running, you know, our only copper smelter in Mount Isa? Is it just down to the age of the asset, or it's just fundamentally uncompetitive with the sector in China?
Yeah, 100%. So yeah, the issue with treatment charges on the downstream side of Mount Isa makes that part of that asset largely uneconomic. So yeah, running just the mines and then exporting the concentrate and turning the smelter off would probably make more money than running the downstream. And that's why there's a move to try and get some fiscal support for those bigger pieces of infrastructure, because the last thing we really want is to have no smelting. We're already seeing alumina refineries close in WA, but again, that's more about the age of the assets than anything else. But otherwise, unless you're investing in the new technology, it's difficult to compete with countries with much lower power costs than what we have.
Yeah, Hayden Bairstow, head of research at finance company Argonaut, speaking there to Clint Jasper about the copper supply. I'll put a podcast of today's program up for you shortly, and there'll be another Country Hour with Richard Bailey reporting from Parana tomorrow after midday.